But there's also other inorganic compounds that have stronger bonds, such as the ones that we use in our experiment. They were hydroxychloride trace minerals, and they tend to be inert in the rumen, if you will, just because of under typical rumen pH of cows between 5.8 and 6.8 or whatever, there will be little solubilization and dissociation. So they tend to not necessarily bypass, because the concept is not correct there, but they tend to not be very active in the rumen. But once they get to the abomasum, they will be ionized, and they will behave from that point on like any other ion.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status to deliver higher milk yield and carcass efficiency. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm happy to welcome a friend and a respected colleague, Dr. Jose Santos from the University of Florida. Jose, thanks for squeezing in some time for this podcast today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Barry, to be here. Have some discussions. I follow some of the podcasts that you guys put together. I'm very happy to be here today.
Well, it's kind of shocking. We haven't twisted your arm into getting on here before, so I'm glad to get to fix that problem today. Maybe people can tell from your accent, or you've been around the world giving talks everywhere, but you didn't grow up in the U.S. Where are you from originally, and how'd you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I'm originally from Brazil, as many of our colleagues in animal science and agriculture seems like.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a small town about 2 hours from the city of São Paulo. My family was all in education, but I had the brother who was very influential. He's in this line of work. He works in bovine nutrition in general. And I eventually went to veterinary college in Brazil. I always liked animals, so I always liked going to farms. And then when I was ready to finish, to be honest, I remember my brother telling me, with all due respect to the veterinary profession, that we only look for diseases and not necessarily for the solution. So I thought about, I better learn some nutrition. And I had the opportunity to come to the United States. I worked for a year in Brazil, and then I came to the University of Arizona to work with Tal Huber, who passed away just recently this last year, unfortunately. And then from Arizona, I eventually moved to California for a clinical residency and stayed there in the faculty for 10 years, and then eventually moved to where I am today, which is the University of Florida.
Fantastic. I think one of the big impacts you've had in our research community is that you were very innovative in working with commercial dairies in California to do well-controlled studies, which is not easy. Partly by finding lots of students who are willing to work very long and difficult days. but you're telling me you continue running studies on dairies in California. And right now, every other week, you're flying across the country to check in on that. That sounds exhausting to me.
Yeah, I've been very lucky to work with a bunch of smart, hardworking students. So, and that's been a blast, you know. And I've always liked the cow. It's kind of I think most of us like the cow, yeah?
Yeah.
I always felt that I want to mix some things. I do, you know, the typical well-controlled experiments at university dairies that have a lot of value, but it also has some limitations, particularly cow numbers. Yeah, it's an issue. And I want to move also to the commercial settings to test what's possible to be tested under those scenarios. And I want to also give the opportunity for graduate students to see that. Yeah, because when you stay just at the university dairy, you see a single scenario. It may not necessarily be what you're going to see after you graduate if you decide to move on into the consulting area or service area other than just the academic field. So, and I've had the opportunity to work with wonderful producers that have been open to accept students coming to the farm and changing things.
Trow Nutrition North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. We support producers in accelerating their journey towards sustainable food production by understanding their challenges and bringing tangible solutions. Trow Nutrition gives our clients access to extensive knowledge, expertise, and resources. Our team of trained advisors is proud to offer on-farm services backed by global research and industry-leading innovation. We go beyond feed. We are dedicated to supporting success together.
You've definitely generated a lot of research that's had a huge impact, but you know, arguably, maybe even your bigger impact is all the students you've trained in. You know, many have come from Brazil or other parts of South America. When's the last time you stopped and counted up how many graduate students you've trained?
I haven't necessarily counted that. I only count when administrators ask me for numbers.
Right.
Yeah, so then I have to count. Yeah, but there's been a graduate students, obviously fewer, but visiting students, yeah, over 100 have come.
Wow.
From different places, a lot from South America, Latin America. Yeah. You know, agriculture is still big in Brazil, and there's a lot of interest. And I think that's part of the reason why we eventually attract people who want to do hands-on type of work, which is a lot what I do. Yeah.
Well, good for you. All right. Well, I guess the focus for today's chat is going to be about transition cow minerals. And this is driven partly by a study that you recently wrapped up. First of all, maybe we should start by talking about different chemistries of trace minerals, if you would. Like, I think when I used to teach this 10 years ago, we'd kind of simplify it into there's inorganic and organic sources, right? But there's more detail than that. Can you help us get up to speed on that chemistry?
The particular experiment that we'll eventually talk about is related to trace minerals, particularly three of them. So I guess I'll focus on that and not, but if there's opportunity, we can talk about other things. But most trace minerals that we supplement, other than what's in the basal diet, is in the form of salts, yeah? Primarily sulfates, but also other salts. Sulfates tend to be the most common, probably because they are more soluble in solutions. So it's assumed that they can easily ionize because they have ionic bonds that are, in general, weak bonds once you get into an aqueous solution, yeah? So they don't share electrons and things like that, like covalent bonds or other types of chemical bonds. So that tends to be the most common. Obviously, the dairy industry has developed methods to combine inorganic compounds with organic compounds, the so-called organic trace minerals, typically linked to a carbohydrate or an amino acid, which is very commonly used in the industry today. But there's also other inorganic compounds that have stronger bonds, such as the ones that we use in our experiment. They were hydroxychloride trace minerals, and they tend to be inert in the rumen, if you will, just because of under typical rumen pH of cows between 5.8 and 6.8 or whatever, there will be little solubilization and dissociation. So they tend to not necessarily bypass, because the concept is not correct, but they tend to not be very active in the rumen. But once they get to the abomasum, they will be ionized, and they will behave from that point on like any other ionized mineral. Yeah. So whether you have sulfates, if you have carbonates, or if you have hydroxychloride, once it's ionized, it will go through the same mechanism of transport and post-absorptive metabolism afterwards.
Is there a reason why we might want to minimize interactions of these trace minerals in the rumen?
In the beef world, one of the reasons people have adopted that is because of taste and preference of particularly baby calves. From the work, I don't read a lot of the literature, but I have colleagues who have done that kind of work. Calves that are in creep feeding type of systems, they tend to not like to eat sulfate sources. There's something there.
Okay.
but they accept better hydroxychlorides. So intake of supplement in those situations seems to be better. I have a colleague here in the department who has done some of that work, and it shows increased intake when this small amounts are included as hydroxychloride. Now, in the dairy world, obviously, having less negative associative interactions is probably beneficial, because releasing those minerals in the rumen, you can have interactions with antagonists, such as, in the case of copper, sulfur, molybdenum, in some situations, they have formed this thiomolybdates that may make it less bioavailable once it gets to the intestine. But also the work that you've done, that you compiled literature looking at fiber digestion in the total tract. So these metal ions, they are antibacterial. So I guess the premise and the hypothesis there is that it's probably killing the fibrolytic bacteria once they are in the ionized form in the rumen, and that decreases what's been measured, which is total tract NDF digestibility, very likely. My assumption, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is because it's affecting rumen digestibility. So the values that you've encountered in the meta-analysis, that 1.5 percentage points change in NDF digestion in the total tract is probably greater in the rumen, I'm assuming, because there's some compensation in the lower gut, yeah?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah, and there's subtle effects, but... interesting, I think, and maybe worth factoring in. Yeah. Okay, awesome. So you tell me about the study that you ran then.
Yeah, so the experiment we've completed, we haven't wrapped up everything. We've only presented abstracts at this point. We're working on the final touches, but it was a typical randomized controlled experiment. It was a randomized block design with 141 cows and two treatments. Basically, we replace sulfate sources of zinc, copper, manganese with hydroxychloride sources at the exact same level when we impose the treatments. So we analyze the ingredients of the diet and we add on top to get to concentrations just above NASEN recommendations. So we follow somewhat Bill Wise guidelines of going a little above the minimum amounts just because of variability and uncertainty. So our diets were designed to be about 60 milligrams per kilo of zinc, 16 copper, and 60 manganese throughout the experiment. So cows were assigned to treatments at 246 days of gestation. We moved them in earlier to train them. And the experiment, the treatment stopped at 105 days in lactation, so about 140 days of treatment.
And just to be clear, Jose, you guys analyzed all the base ingredients of the different diets you're feeding, so that you're actually supplementing to hit target concentrations instead of assuming nothing in the base diet, right?
That is correct. Our basal diet had about 7 milligrams of copper, 30 of zinc, and 26, 28 of manganese. We did so many analyses. Probably between all the supplements we use, every batch of grain mix, every batch of mineral water and feeds, for ICP analysis, maybe 80 or 90 samples. Yeah, so, and you'll be surprised how much variability there is. Yeah, for whatever reason, our sampling technique, separation or lab issues. ICP is pretty precise. I like to think that's probably something behind the scenes, not in the lab. But yeah, we did a lot of analysis. So these values that I told you, the 60, 16, 60, is the total diet, not the supplemental.
Thank you.
And then we follow cows to 105 days with daily measurements, your traditional daily intake, daily production. We had milk sampling four times a week, daily body weights, and we characterized disease. We collect embryos from cows, day 16 embryos, and then cows were turned back to the herd and they followed their lives, and we just followed them until they complete 300 days to see what happened in that lactation, because I feel like that's pretty important.
And this was all done at the university facility?
It was done at the University of Florida. I had the two key students who worked on that, a master's student who completed the project, and a PhD student who still were doing the lab work for that.
Okay, so what were some of the key takeaways from the study?
Probably the key findings, probably the most important find, although this is a relatively small experiment for binary data, yes or no, we had less morbidity. Our retained placenta dropped from 11 to 3%. We had very few cases of, we had one case of mastitis, two cases of LDA. We had five lame cows, four or five lame cows that we do lameness scoring during the experiment. So the key disease that we call as morbidity were really uterine disease, were retained placenta and metritis. And morbidity was less. So it dropped from 50% to about 32%.
So it was better in the hydroxychloride treatment.
Better in the hydroxychloride. And I think that set the stage for everything else that we found in the experiment. Although that's sort of my simplistic take on it. Yeah, there may be things behind the scenes that we may not necessarily be able to quantify and determine. But health of the cows was better. And that resulted in 1.4 kilograms more energy-corrected milk in the 105 days. We did something that we back-calculate the NEL of the diet based on the energy output of the cows, the dry matter intake of the cows, the maintenance requirements. We assume 100 kilocalories per kilogram metabolic weight, which is the only thing that we are assuming that we cannot measure. And we back calculated. So in the first 4 weeks, there was a difference between treatments, which I attribute to the reduced health events in those cows. So it was better for the hydroxychloride. Once we passed 4 weeks, then the lines are superposed. And it was exactly what the NASN predicted. So okay. I was very happy because, you know, those guys did a lot of hard work and the NASN predicted very precisely based on at least in this experiment. So our calculated NEL from the diet using NASN with the individual ingredients analyzed was about 1.85 megacalories per kilo. And after 4 weeks, our estimated NEL was exactly that using daily body weight changes, milk energy output, those types of things. Amazing. And dry matter intake, yeah. But early on, the values are more variable because a lot of it is body weight changes. Eh? A cow doesn't eat very well today. Her gut feel changes. She drops in body weight. And then, but in that stage, the hydroxychloride had higher or greater estimated NEL content.
Yeah, maybe from reduced maintenance costs, right, due to
disease and things like
okay,
that. Yeah.
Interesting. In terms of sort of end users thinking about return on investment for something like this, probably, I have no idea what the cost difference would be between these things. Maybe you don't either, but
he'd be surprised how for an individual cow, how little that is. If you think about a cow today, if she makes three lactations, yeah, and you go to a good herd, first lactation, she produces 11, 12,000 kilos, and then she goes up 13 to 15. So, and then she generates, let's say, 1.5 females, 1.5 males in this lifetime. And you get these prices of beef on dairy calves and the good price of heifers today, all of that. These cows, give or take some, they're generating $6,000-$7,000 a lactation.
Yep.
To supplement the amount of metal that we did from zinc, copper, and manganese, if we use sulfate sources, it would be, to the best that I've seen the prices with colleagues, $2.50 per lactation.
Wow.
And if you use a more expensive product, that's hydroxychloride per unit of metal, it would be just shy of $4 per lactation.
Okay.
Per unit of bioavailable metal, then it depends how you place your product. Yeah. So if you use the numbers that people have used, like let's say zinc is 20% bioavailable, copper 5, and manganese is, I think, 0.75 or something like that. and then they look at relative bioavailability of all this design or commercial products, always a little higher, then the price difference becomes smaller and maybe somewhat comparable. But it's very small difference. So that's one of those that if they are able to replicate findings like this, because obviously it's one experiment, yeah? So you always need to replicate things. It's an easy pay. It's no-brainer if you get half of those things.
It is good to think about things on absolute terms. I like the way you phrase that, because it's like, oh, that's, you know, 70% more expensive. That's crazy. $100 per cow per year.
It's like, you know, the news. New study from Harvard says that if you do this, your risk of dying increases 50%. But it's 1 in 1 million, and it's 1.5 in 1 million. Yeah, so
exactly.
Should you be worried about that?
Perfect analogy. Well, we were talking before we started recording here a little bit about something that I've been getting up to speed on a little bit more, which is at least from my vantage point, a growing concern or growing evidence about a high fraction of our dairy cows in the developed world that are probably on the borderline of copper toxicity, and maybe other mineral imbalances as well, trace mineral imbalances. You've had some experience with that. What are your thoughts on that? Is that something we should be concerned about?
I think if you talk to people out there, they've had experiences in the past because of mistakes, you know, in either delivery of a product or formulation, more likely delivery of a product contamination. I had two experiences. One was with copper in heifers, and one was with magnesium in the whole herd because of they had some residual magnesium oxide in the delivery truck, and they dumped mineral mix. Yeah, it was diarrhea everywhere in the herd. So it's like taking the whole bottle of milk magnesia and you see what happens.
Just like in humans.
Yeah, exactly. So, but there is valid concern about copper because there has been overfeeding of copper. Yeah? So I was mentioning to you, one year I did this, not necessarily a survey, I just asked three labs to tell me how many samples they analyzed over the last few years for your traditional nitrogen, NDF, ADF, and how many of those samples they also analyzed for minerals. And minerals is a fraction, so maybe 10%. So that tells me that most nutritionists don't bother doing chemical analysis for minerals, even less for trace minerals. So a lot of times the baseline diet gets ignored and people add on top. And then probably for most trace minerals, that is just an expense and a burden in the environment, but less of an issue to the cow. Yeah? But when it gets to copper, that is a concern, particularly as the U.S. herd moves into a little bit more Jersey cows, and they tend to be somewhat more sensitive and accumulate more copper. So then I think we need to be aware of that. But there's been some reports of copper toxicity. I've talked to nutritionists that had issues, overt clinical signs confirmed by pathology diagnosis and heavy metal assays. So I think we should not ignore that there is being overfeeding, and we need to be aware of it.
One thing I hadn't really thought about much until recently is, you know, if we've been using copper sulfate for foot baths for two decades, you know, and you haven't analyzed trace minerals from homegrown crops for 10 years, you know, if we have a slow accumulation of copper in the soil, we can assume that the crops will be accumulating copper, right?
Yeah,
so we probably are seeing shifts.
Particularly if you have winter forages in alfalfa that you're harvesting close to the soil, you get more soil contamination. Like when I was in California, it wasn't uncommon to have forages with 12 ppm of copper, you know, 35, 40 ppm of zinc, manganese. So, and there's no reason to believe that metal is not available to the cow. Yeah? So why ignore that? So there is an opportunity for some savings. And if you save there, you can probably spend an extra dollar in your trace mineral supplement to use something that potentially might pay back. Yeah. So to me, it's just logical. We don't ignore other nutrients. Yeah.
I'll have to dig this paper up and share it with you, but I found a paper just recently. It was published, I think, in just in the last few months, a controlled study in growing heifers feeding right at the requirement or 2x, which is very common. And they basically showed that the heifers that were overfed copper had about a 20% drop in pregnancy rate after the first two services. It was a pretty interesting outcome.
It makes sense. If you look at probably every nutrient, you have inadequate.
Yeah.
You have what you would consider adequate or ideal. And in excess, they tend to do the same bad things that inadequate does. Yeah?
Yep. Absolutely.
So when you get to the toxicity, somehow our body makes it such that we express the same bad symptoms as if you didn't get enough. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Thanks for sharing. I look forward to seeing all the papers from that study. Sounds like a lot of work and a lot of good insights from it.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. It was good work. I think we'll be well received and we'll benefit the industry, which is important.
Absolutely.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Trow Nutrition, North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Expand your feed possibilities with a trusted partner. You can count on Schooler for consistent, high-quality feed ingredients with reliable delivery. Access an extensive portfolio of product options that fit your unique rations and cost parameters and get the essential nutrition solutions for your herd at all stages of life. Visit schooler.com/feed to learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. That's Schooler, schooler.com/feed.
Okay, well, we have three questions we always ask every guest, at least on their first visit to the show. So I'm looking forward to your responses here. So first of all, do you have a favorite dairy-related book or resource that you turn to the most?
I read a lot of the Nason book lately.
Okay.
So I like that because I can find a lot of references that I can go back and see what the original paper showed. I think they've done a great job with that. So now, if I had to pick one, a technical book, I would probably say the 2021 Nason Dairy Cattle book.
And for anybody that doesn't get that reference, so NASEM is short for National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. So that National Academies imprint has been publishing the nutrient requirements of livestock and other species for over 100 years now. And so, yeah, we've got a new version just 3 years ago for dairy cattle, and I agree it's an excellent resource. All right, second question. I know you are a voracious reader and your incredible memory. Do you have a favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Well, I have a favorite book. Actually, my reading is probably boring because the things that I like are somewhat narrow. I like medical literature and history of science, so I read those things. And I like some novels and things related to eating and agriculture. But I'll tell you what I'm reading just right now. maybe a year ago, I watched a show on PBS called The Gene, which was two shows. You can probably still go and watch again. I probably should watch it again. Talking about the revolution on genetics with genomics. Yeah. And tailored medicine based on genes and talks about all this human disease because of recessive genes that are either bad or lethal. And so I'm reading this book that a medical doctor, I think he's from Columbia University, wrote, which is related to those two shows on PBS. That's called The Genes.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful book that tells you history of genetics, going all the way back to Pythagoras, Gregory Mendel. And Gregory Mendel is an amazing guy. So he should have received Nobel Prize, because out of nothing, you know, a monk somewhere in Belgium or Austria-Hungarian empire decide to do those experiments with peas, and he came to the conclusions that we still use today. And I'm pretty ignorant in genetics. Believe me, I'm not far from, but I have enough colleagues and a good one in Wisconsin that influenced me a lot in thinking about genetics. And yeah, when I go back and I look at what those people did without any basic knowledge and just out of the blue, it's quite amazing. So I like to read that kind of literature because it opens my eyes to these people that develop things out of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Mendel was probably, what, 80 years ahead of the next person who could actually understand what he was doing, right?
Exactly. And people question him in the early 1900s. There was two people, like when he published his papers, the papers got hidden somewhere. It was not in the international literature or national literature. And then there were two plant, I think, botanists who found his papers and decided to replicate the experiments. And he found exactly what he showed. And then he came to the whole story of DNA, where genes are located and how you transmit your inheritance to the next generation. Yeah, it was quite, it's quite amazing. And then in the book, they talk a lot about the history of that. And then they move on into the modern medicine and the use of genomics for treatment of particularly kids that have genetic disorders.
It's
an excellent reading. Somebody who likes science and what happens in day-to-day life, that's an excellent reading. The author's name is, it's difficult for me to pronounce, but it's a Hindu name. He's a medical doctor, geneticist, virologist, Siddhartha Mukherjee or something like that. But if you type the genes book, history, it will tell you, it will show you immediately.
All right, last question then. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
Not sure if it is dairy professions, but professions in general, yeah? I think they are detail-oriented. They are persistent and resilient. In the dairy world, I would say they're great communicators. You have to communicate with your customers, but you have to know the science, or at least know where to find the information and have the contacts. Because there's a lot of science today. It's not just art, yeah, as it used to be. So I would say those are major attributes. Be resilient, persistent. The ones that I know that I, if I had a dairy farm, I would probably hire to be my consultant. Or the dairy people, the owners that I think are very successful, they are excellent communicators. Many of them speak more than one language, so they can communicate with their staff, so they speak Spanish or something else. They are very resilient. They are innovative. They don't settle very easily. So I think those things make most of them quite successful. And probably comes from home, yeah? What you learn as you grow up from your parents, your education.
Excellent. Well, Jose, I think that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks so much for joining. It was a great conversation.
Well, thank you for having me, Barry. Really enjoyed.
This has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show, and with today's guest, Dr. Jose Santos. If you enjoyed that episode and you're not already subscribed, make sure you hit that button so you don't miss the next episode. We'll see you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.